and welcome to The Wire, your national and independent coverage of current affairs right across Australia on community and Indigenous radio. I'm Tony Pankaluik, coming to you from Radio 4EB in Mianjin, Brisbane. And today on the show,
what we found is that one in three Australians can't tell if online content is real or is AI-generated, and it's really, really important that people are able to tell.
A new research shows Australia's digital gap is concerning, especially when AI is becoming more sophisticated. We have all the details. Also, a new report shows misinformation was rife during the last federal election. And later today,
the more people get out and talk to their neighbours, I'm sure half the people down here, because there's so many apartments, don't know who their next door neighbour is. So this is so important to get out and meet people. So it's fantastic.
A community comes together to kick off their initial wellness walk. We'll have this and more for you over the next half hour. Thanks for being with us today. We're on air across Australia, thanks to the Community Radio Network and the support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. First up today, more than $13 billion annually. That's how much Australia loses on poker machines, a figure ranking the highest worldwide. Over 3 million Australians are affected by gambling harm each year, with lives and families left shattered. As the nation witnesses Gambling Harm Action Week, Gambling Harm Lived Experience experts have launched Lost Limits, Not Lost Lives, a national campaign calling for governments to enforce lost limits on poker machines, with the petition spearheaded by co-chair Kate Cecilia. She survived a 15-year addiction and nearly lost everything, and she spoke to The Wire's Tia Bailey to reflect on gambling harms.
As an 18-year-old, I went into social spaces I assumed were safe, and they were filled with poker machines. It got out of control very quickly. You know, there was absolutely nothing in the media at that time about gambling harm. I was just left trying to figure it out on my own. I had no idea if there was any help that was available. When I did end up, after a couple of years, calling Lifeline, I was told, just don't wear shoes. If you don't wear shoes, you won't be able to get into a venue, so you won't be able to gamble. And I was like, right, okay. I said, if I was addicted to drugs, there would be a rehab. Like, where could I go to have rehab? They said, oh, there's no rehab for gambling. And if there was, it'd be for men. That made me feel like I was the only female experiencing gambling harm. That just shut me down for another 5 years before I put my hand up for help again. It was horrific. For me, you know, the flow-on effects of losing money so quickly creates a sense of stress and anxiety, depression, overwhelming regret, and, you know, just feeling unsafe in your body because you don't understand the interaction that is happening. That's why I moved into educating the community on this level of harm, because it is just so insidious and yet so profoundly misunderstood by people buying the industry narrative that it's just harmless fun. It's not. It's addiction by design.
The way you've turned your experience around and then channeled it into education, it really is inspiring. I mean, years down the line, do you believe that this experience has impacted your role as a mother?
The years, you know, in the last decade, it's made me so much more conscious of the environments that I put my children into and educated them on how to navigate their way through this world that is essentially unsafe.
Dr. Simone McCarthy is a postdoctoral research fellow at Deakin University. Her study focused on women's lived experience of gambling-related harm.
We've done a bit of research with older adults and older women and their experiences of gambling harm. Women have told me that they find gambling venues attractive to combat loneliness and social isolation, so things like retirement or widowhood. There's not a lot of places where older women can go on their own and sit for long periods of time, so they're really viewed as safe and welcome and socially acceptable places. They've got security guards, friendly staff that they know your name, and they're accessible at nighttime, which some older people have told me that they've gone there to escape conflict at home as well.
How do you believe the gambling industry psychologically targets individuals, specifically in the form of poker machines, and are there particular groups most affected?
So Australians lose approximately $32 billion on gambling each year, and roughly 50% of that comes from losses on electronic gambling machines or pokies in community settings.
A lot of public messaging still tells people to gamble responsibly. Mm-hmm. Do you think that framing misses the mark when it comes to addressing gambling harm? Do governments need to be more accountable?
100%, yeah. Governments have primarily focused on kind of that individualized behavioral addiction frameworks rather than population-based public health harm prevention strategy. So we need regulation that changes the harmful design of poker machines, regulation that helps limit the amount of money that can be lost in such a small amount of time.
According to the Australian Institute of Health and Welfare in 2022 to 2023, Australians spent $31.5 billion. When it comes to poker machine use, the Australian Institute say we are losing around $13 billion per year, with numbers only rising. The latest campaign calls for governments to enforce loss limits on poker machines, including $100 per day, $500 per month, and $5,000 per year. Mrs. Sisalja says the campaign is a necessary step to raise awareness about the issue.
This campaign is absolutely designed to save lives. There is a feature on the petition that you can leave comments and videos of support for this change. And we want to hear from as many of you in the public that have experienced gambling harm or had a loved one in your family experience gambling harm. These voices are important. They've been limited by shame that was never theirs to carry.
That was petition organiser Kate Cecilia there, speaking with The Wire's Tia Bailey. A new research by Good Things Australia shows almost half of Australians find it difficult to spot a scam, and nearly a third of Australians don't know the difference between real content and AI-generated one. The most vulnerable sector to scams are grandparents, but also young adults aged 25 to 34 struggle to bank online, meaning the digital gap is across the board. Last week, Get Online Week raised awareness about how important digital skills are and produced resources for everyone to use. The Wire's Eduardo Jordan started asking CEO of Good Things Australia, Jess Wilson, to explain more about the research.
So we were really interested in understanding where Australians were thinking about technology today, because so much of our world requires us to be engaged in technology. And what we found is that one in three Australians can't tell if online content is real or is AI generated. And with, you know, so much AI generated content being available today, it's really, really important that people are able to tell. And actually, almost half of Australians were saying that scams are getting harder to spot. So, I mean, that's really important for us to be supporting people around, because we don't want people to get scammed. I mean, the last thing I would say is that one in four Australians were worried about how AI will affect them and their loved ones. So, you know, clearly Australians are thinking a lot about the impact of AI and emerging technologies on their lives.
Now, what's the biggest risk for people who can't spot AI-generated content or, you know, being in front of a scam?
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest risk around not being able to spot AI-generated content is two things. One is scams, so people being scammed out of money. And the other is around misinformation and making big decisions based on information that's not correct. So they're really the two key things that we see as key problems for people today.
So, Jess, why are digital skills so important these days? And why do you think there's a gap in digital literacy in Australia?
Well, I mean, digital skills are important because just about everything we do in our society today requires us to engage with technology in some way. So, if it is about, you know, accessing government services, if you're in a remote community or and you want to access telehealth or you want to access banking services, any of those things, you need to be able to have technology. So internet connection and the technology and skills to be able to use it. So that's really, really important. If we want to be learning, if kids want to be engaging in school and education, you need to have those digital skills to be able to do that. So it's really, really important that we have the digital skills and confidence to be able to participate. I mean, what we know is that people still feel a little bit less confident around keeping up with technology today. So we want to make sure that people have the opportunity to learn in a way that makes them feel confident and in a way that's supported.
And I'm guessing this goes towards more, you know, elderly people and people in regional communities. Am I correct in assuming this?
The people that are more likely to be less confident with digital skills are definitely older people. So older people are likely to need a bit of extra support in staying up to date. But it's not just older people. We actually know that young people, with people, everybody assumes that they are digital natives, but they might be able to use a mobile phone, but get them to write an email or use a laptop to do their learning, that may still be a challenge for people. Also, we know people with disabilities are more likely to be digitally excluded, so not as feel as confident. And people who are refugees or migrants who have come to this country and have English as a second language also struggle with that access to technology.
Now, last week you had the Get Online Week. What was the purpose of this week and how did Australians react to Get Online Week?
Yeah, Get Online Week is a yearly campaign that we have, and we have 700 events happening all over the country where people get to go to a community space, so a library or a community centre or a local support group, where they can learn something about technology and do that in a fun and really lighthearted and supportive way. Because we know that people learn best when they're in a place where they already feel comfortable, and so it's really important that we have those kinds of opportunities for people to learn.
And what can Australians do to be more tech-savvy in spotting scams and AI-generated content? And where can we get more information about this?
Well, definitely I would recommend people have a look at our website, goodthingsaustralia.org. There are some amazing resources there on how to spot deepfakes and get people to practice. There are some games on there where you can kind of test yourself about whether you can spot which thing is AI generated or not. So there's some great content available there. I mean, what I would say is it's really important for people, if they see something that is too good to be true, then it probably is. So please don't, you know, make hard, big decisions about something without talking to another person. So having a trusted person you can check things with is really important to being able to manage scams.
CEO of Good Things Australia, Jess Wilson there, speaking with The Wire's Eduardo Jordan. You're listening to The Wire, independent current affairs on community and Indigenous radio. I'm Tony Pankaluwik in Brisbane. A big hello to our friends in Alice Springs on 8CCC, to our listeners in Hobart on Print Radio Tasmania, and to the other side of the country, to Radio Goolari in Broome, Western Australia. A new report finds nearly 60% of adult Australians reported encountering misinformation during the lead-up to the 2025 federal election. Most Australians are concerned about the ever-growing rise in false information within the media landscape, as well as facing difficulty in separating fact from fiction. I spoke with Professor of Communication at the University of Canberra's News and Media Research Centre, Dr. Sora Park, to learn more about the findings.
So we wanted to know how Australian voters experience misinformation during an election. So we conducted an online survey shortly after the election in May to see what their experiences were and were they comfortable and confident in verifying misinformation during the election.
So what were some of the major findings in the report that you found very interesting?
First thing is that people experience experienced misinformation quite a lot. Many people said they saw something, false information about the election. 40% of people said they did. More importantly, the majority of people were very worried about that there was lots of misinformation during the election and that they weren't confident that they had the ability to verify it.
What about the results? Like, how do they differ from the various sides of, say, the political spectrum, say, left versus center versus right, in terms of identifying the misinformation scene?
Well, it was across the board. Everyone had low confidence, and we also measured their actual ability. So we gave them 5 examples of misinformation that were widely circulated during the election to see if they could verify it. Only about half of the people were able to say it's misinformation, and whether you're left or right, it was across the board.
Were there any notable differences between older and younger Australians? If you could expand more into the key differences.
Yes, so young people generally are more confident that they can see misinformation and know that it's misinformation. And it's mainly because they're on social media a lot and they know algorithms. They think, oh, I can easily verify misinformation. But when we actually did the test, they scored actually lower than older people. And part of the reason is that older demographics tend to pay more attention to news media. They have been exposed to accurate information, and when they see misinformation, they can discern it. Whereas younger people, because they're not consuming news as much as older people, the ability is much lower.
So what about with regards to the topics? Which ones in the category, say, like if it's environment or finance or whatever it may be, which one had most misinformation in those types of topic categories? Could you talk a little bit about that?
We did ask what topics of misinformation did you come across during the election campaign. The top topic was cost of living. Obviously, people are very interested in that topic, so they've seen a lot of misinformation on that. But they also saw misinformation about nuclear, climate change, immigration, and housing crisis. So the key topics that were discussed during the election campaign were also the topics that they saw a lot of misinformation about.
And is this type of study that you and the team have conducted, is this the first of this type of nature? Because the reason why I'm asking this is we hear misinformation a lot more now in this digital age that we're in, with everything being so proliferated in terms of the news and artificial intelligence, so many different factors.
So this is the first we've done in relation to election specifically, but we've been studying misinformation for many years now. For example, during COVID, we did a misinformation study about COVID, and we do an annual news consumption survey, and we, in most years, we ask questions about people's experience of misinformation and how concerned they are. And Australia, among 48 countries we survey, has the highest concern about misinformation in the world.
With that being said, like, for the future, what do you think should be done to combat misinformation? Because I understand, like, there would be misinformation that occurs in some form, no matter what. But what are some ways the country should implement strategies in combating misinformation?
So misinformation is here with us and we have to live with it. That's a fact. We can't remove all the misinformation. That's not possible. But there are things we can do as society to help mitigate the impact of it. First, we really need to regulate the digital platforms where most of the misinformation is circulated to make it a more safe environment. We also need to educate the public on their media literacy so they can actually discern misinformation. And in this study, we found that people who have had media literacy education are much more likely to be able to detect misinformation. We also found that people who access news regularly and are active news consumers, in other words, people who have access to quality information and news, have a higher ability to discern misinformation, meaning that we really have to keep our news environment high quality and make sure that trustworthy news is available to everyone.
That was Dr. Sora Puck from the University of Canberra ending the report. This week, Gosford kicked off its initial wellness walk, raising funds for local causes. The City of Gosford Rotary Club brought together local businesses, residents, and health professionals to support charities across the area. One of the walkers was Mayor Laurie McKinna, who raised funds for the not-for-profit Walk It Off, and he spoke with The Wire's Martin Davies about the event and his community.
It's great because I actually walk down here maybe three or four nights a week with my dog, and I just love the fact that I walk along here and I know people, or I get to know people just because I'm walking. And because I've got a dog, not because of me, but because I've got a cute dog, you talk to people, and it's so important. And that's why the charity Walk Off, this is fantastic for them. And the more people get out and talk to their neighbours, I'm sure half the people down here, because there's so many apartments, don't know who their next door neighbour is. So this is so important to get out, meet people. So it's fantastic.
You're focusing on connectivity of people, making those connections. Yeah. Do you think that's really important for community?
Big time. I built my life doing it. That's why I'm the mayor. Okay, you know, come out here and was the Mariners coach, but what sold the Mariners was what we did in the community and did with people. And if you don't communicate and don't make an effort, yeah, some days you don't feel like it, but that's when you need it more than ever to cheer you up. Somebody's going to say something that's going to put a smile on your face, you know, and that's what it's all about. And when I go and walk my dog and somebody tells me how cute a dog, you know, I get jealous and what's wrong with me, you know. And but you have a bit of banter, and that's what's great. And to see everybody down here this morning, everybody's had a nice morning, everybody's had their wee walk, and it's fantastic.
You've had a life, and particularly I imagine as the mayor, where you take a lot of pressure. So how do you manage your own mental health?
Great question, because during my time at Newcastle Jets, when the owner stopped paying money, I had problems as well, because I'd put a lot of money in the club that I lost and I'll never get back. And it was how I dealt with it. And I started swimming in the morning at Terrigal. So I go down most mornings when I can and I swim. I go a walk and I swim. And when we walk, we spend most of the time talking to people. Going to swim, we talk to people. And we just talk rubbish, have a cup of tea, sit, and I do that most mornings. And that's what's good for me, because it's the best bit of my day, especially when you've had a big council meeting the night before. But through Newcastle Jets time, I was struggling. And that's what helped me get through it. It was going down to a swimming group, walking, and just talking to people. And not talking about football, just talking normal banter. And that's what helped me get through it.
And as the mayor of Gosford, what do you think would be a kind of a statement of what you would like this city, and indeed the Central Coast region where you're the mayor of, to be in terms of mental health?
We're getting more and more people moving here. Their apartments going up everywhere, which is fantastic. The city's changing. But they're no use coming here and sitting in your wee house, your wee apartment, four walls and looking at it. You have to get out there. We need to make a statement. You want people to come here. You want to say good morning to somebody when you walk past them. Don't walk with your head down. Walk with your head up. Be proud of where you are and what you are, and so people can talk to you. I look everybody to see if they speak to me. If somebody, I love just saying good morning, and you meet so many interesting people. And it's, I go home now and my wife says, what friends have you met today? And that's talking about my dog's friends. So I'm just encourage people, talk to your neighbours, talk to people on the street, talk to your colleagues. And if you need somebody to talk to, ask one of your friends, because that's what they're there for. People are there to help you. And sometimes you just need to put your hand up and ask for help. Don't be shy.
And as Gosford develops so rapidly now, do you think that this is going to be consciously a part of your strategy to get mental health up? Because if you've got a happy city, then you're going to have a happy mayor, aren't you?
Definitely. You've got the library in there now, and the thousands and thousands of people are going through the new library, and they're all meeting people, because they're going in this library for the first time. They're meeting people, meeting friends. It's bringing people together, and that's what we need. We need more events. Like, we just announced the Matildas are coming here on the 28th. You're going to have 20,000 people. A lot of them's from the coast, but a lot of them's from outside the coast. But bringing people together and getting that buzz off each, because I get buzzing when I'm talking to people. I start misbehaving a bit, because you get a vibe and you get good and you get excited, and sometimes I say some inappropriate things, all meant in a good way. But I feed off that, and I think other people, I know they've got their head down and they maybe feel they're going through a bad patch, but other people are doing it as well. But your mates are there for you, and the people in this community are there.
Mayor of Gosford, Laurie McKenna there, speaking with The Wire's Martin Davies. And that's the end of the show today. Thanks so much for listening. wherever you are in Australia. The Wire is a co-production between community radio stations 2SER, Radio Adelaide, 4ZZZ, and Radio 4EB in Melbourne and Brisbane, with the great support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation and the Community Radio Network. We'll see you next week, same time, on your local station. And if you'd like to listen to any one of our stories again, you can go to our website at thewire.org.au. The Wire acknowledges the traditional custodians of the Turrbal and Yuggera countries, where this program has been produced, and we pay our respects to Aboriginal elders, past, present, and emerging. Today, The Wire came to you from Radio 4EB in Brisbane. I'm Tony Pankaluik. Thanks so much for your company, and we'll see you next time on The Wire.